It's Wednesday, August 30th, 2017, and this is KBIA's Views of the News. Our weekly roundtable on media behaviors comes to you from the Futures Lab studio at the Reynolds Journalism Institute. I'm Amy Simons, and here with me are my colleagues, Mike McKean and Ernest Perry. On our program this week, ESPN's decision to pull broadcaster Robert Lee off the University of Virginia game because of concerns about the neo-Nazi march in Charlottesville 2 weeks ago. How about a tribute to Robert E. Lee that's being called into question here in Columbia and how those discussions are being covered by our local news organizations? And we'll also tell the tale of a novel pulled from the New York Times bestseller list. We'll tell you all of that and more before our half hour is up today. But first, the breathtaking stories and images coming out of southern Texas, now 5-6 days after Hurricane Harvey, hit the mainland as a Category 4 storm, leaving Galveston, Corpus Christi, San Antonio, and Houston, along with countless other smaller cities and towns, devastated by the high winds and the feet of water. Reporters in the region have stepped up to cover this in ways we haven't seen since the days of Katrina, exactly 12 years ago this week. We're going to talk about how the storm coverage has changed in that time, but first I want to talk about some of the amazing tales we're hearing about the work that reporters are doing on the ground, like that of KHOU's Brandy Smith. She was standing on a Houston overpass when she saw the floodwaters swallowing up a 16-wheeler, its driver trapped inside while the cab filled with water. As she was watching a pickup truck approach, the Harris County Sheriff was towing a boat. She flagged down the officers, pointed out the truck, and facilitated the driver's rescue. Let's take a listen to her first words to the driver after that.
I'm so glad these guys were on hand, that we were able to direct them to you.
No doubt.
Did they tell you this is the same spot a year ago where another driver died?
Most definitely. I just thank God that you guys was right here to get me. Put me back on land safe. I appreciate you.
This is gonna sound weird, but can I hug you? I'm so happy you're okay. Thank you so much. Stay safe, stay dry.
Reporters and journalists on the ground having some more of the access to boats or to vehicles that are able to get through into some of these areas and facilitating a lot of rescues just like that one.
Houston's my hometown, yeah. And I have family there. They're all safe at this point. And the rain has stopped and the water's starting to recede. They're still dealing with issues of overfilled dams and levees that they're trying to figure out. But, you know, when you look at the reports from down there, I mean, it does bring back Katrina. But I think many of the differences is that you're seeing it in even more real time, and you have more social media now than you had back then. So you have
by more we mean by, all well, yes, of the social media. I mean, none all, of that yeah, really
none
existed.
Of that existed.
12
I mean,
years
and,
ago.
And the, I think the big thing that you're seeing is that social media is giving not only reporters but first responders the ability to see where people are and get to them in a more timely fashion than you saw back during Katrina. And I think that's helped in a lot of different ways.
Yeah, like Ernest, I have family, a brother and sister-in-law and their kids down there, and I used to work there way, way long, long time ago. Still know some of the journalists that are there.
Yeah.
So I've been watching it with somewhat more than casual interest. And the thing that I found is when you talk about social media, you could imagine it maybe a few years ago being a tool for the reporters, mm-hmm. right, to gather information. But now it's being used by people to coordinate rescues. It's being used by people to shame, like this mega pastor down there, who Joel Osteen, to finally open up his church, former basketball arena, to people as a shelter when at first he hadn't done so. I mean, it's being used to coordinate the actual distribution of aid. So that's probably the biggest difference between now and previous big storms like
that. Yeah, I would say that. I mean, the other thing, and you brought up the Joel Osteen issue. I mean, it's also opened up discussion about, you know, what really is emergency management? What really is having to deal with a catastrophe? I mean, the amount of coverage that you've seen over the last 4 or 5 days has just been huge. But you also have people asking questions: should Houston have been evacuated? Well, I mean, that question to me is at this point in time makes no sense, even though you have reporters asking this. Like, you're talking about a city of 4.5 million people. The last time they tried to evacuate Houston, you had more people die trying to get out than you had from the storm. Where are you going to, how are you going to evacuate a city of 4.5 million people in less than 48 hours or 72 hours? That's almost an impossibility, especially when you're dealing with a storm as large as this was. I mean, and so when reporters ask those questions, usually reporters who are from outside of the area and aren't in the disaster zone asking those questions, it makes it seem as if, you know, they're trying to get to who we're going to blame before we even deal with how we're going to help.
I will say that when, you know, you show the clip of the reporter from KHOU who became a social media celebrity, I don't know, 1.5 million views of that video or whatever. And I know that she and many of the other journalists who were out there in the field covering this story did treat it in very personal terms. Mm-hmm. They weren't just standing there taking advantage of somebody else's misery. There were many, many examples of live shots, for example, where reporters were helping people with old people with their luggage getting out of boats.
Identifying where people were,
like that.
so that law enforcement and first responders could get to them.
Another one on CNN over the weekend too, Ed Lavandera was in a boat and was going from house to house rescuing people and actually asking at one point, I remember there was one I saw where he helped an older man into the boat and then said, I'm hearing that his daughter and wife are inside. The wife has Alzheimer's. Why don't you go away from us for a little while? We can come back and talk to you in a little bit. Let me help people. And you go to somebody else's live shot for a little bit.
My only concern with the live coverage, especially from the boats pulling up to people's houses with reporters in tow, what happens if you stumble across a really grisly scenario? I know that one station I was watching live streaming on my iPad, and I saw a traffic cam from a Houston intersection, and basically they showed this car like that truck that was deeply submerged. They thought somebody was in it because the windshield wipers were still going back and forth. They were trying to execute a rescue with a boat, and that camera was on them live the whole time. What if the person in the car had not survived? Well, we would have seen that live.
And that's
I'm not
a
sure
challenge,
we should have.
And that's a challenge that we face with all kinds of live video coverage, especially as Facebook Live has become something that stations and that news organizations are taking advantage of as a tool so readily. Is are you prepared for the worst to potentially happen during that live
and that's,
coverage?
I mean, that's one of the issues that I think we really need to, in the media, especially as we begin to use more and more of social media and it becomes more and more accessible, like Facebook Live and that sort of thing. What are the ethical challenges? We don't have a delay. Should we have a delay? What does that delay mean? Who's the audience that we're trying to reach, and what is the information we're trying to convey? Or are we just basically becoming this voyeuristic kind of let's see what happens next kind of thing? We really need to sit down and think about that, and we talk about doing that after each one of these disasters, but I don't think we're taking the time to
and
do
we
that.
Find ourselves in this situation again with the next disaster.
Yes, we do.
We'd be remiss if we didn't talk about the fact, especially as we laud the local journalists and local media for bringing this story across the country to all of us, we'd be remiss if we didn't take note of the fact that their homes are potentially in danger, their family members in danger, and that they're stepping away from that to bring the story. And one of the things that's interesting that we're seeing today in the coverage that maybe we didn't see even with Hurricane Sandy, or that we definitely weren't seeing with Katrina, is that the advances in technology, again, coming back to the advances in cellular technology, are making it really easy for some of these large corporate ownership chains to help out sister stations. I can bring up one example because we aren't tied to the idea of satellite trucks that require line of sight anymore, that a lot of live shots are done using cellular data, that one of our former students, Carrie Leary, was telling us about how she at KUSA in Denver is boothing some of that KHOU content
because the station was flooded
because KHOU underwater facilities not being able to be used. They're being anchored out of the local PBS station, but that different Tegna TV stations across the country are taking turns because live shots are being tuned in via cell phone. It isn't as though we needed technology we were tied to 10 years ago or 20 or 30 years ago that we're able to nimbly produce content for one another. We kind of rolled our eyes at it when Sinclair was doing the Toledo newscast out of South Bend, but this is a practical application that really does help.
Right, and I don't mean this as a defense of corporate media, because there are lots of things with these big companies owning local media that are problematic. But the other thing you saw was that a lot of these stations, their groups were sending in reporters from outside the market as well to come in and to supplement the coverage of their own teams or to spell them, because a lot of those reporters have been working nonstop. And so that was also very helpful that they had additional trained people who could come in and help tell that story.
It creates a bench, because you do have the standardized operations and training and programs in terms of actual computer hardware software from station to station.
And it does give those stations, because they're on the air covering the story 24/7, the ability to do that. I mean, think about it. I mean, KHOU was underwater. So if it didn't have a way to actually do that, that station wouldn't be providing that kind of coverage.
So, Ernest, you had mentioned that it's way too early to be asking the question, should Houston have been evacuated? That there's questions that we're asking too soon. So what should the focus be right now, and at what point should some of those other storylines be starting to come through?
I mean, I think the focus...
I mean, you two obviously know this market way better than I ever do.
I mean, I think the focus right now should be on doing an assessment of the damage, and you still have the issue of the water in those behind those dams and behind those levees that is still rising, because the water has nowhere to go, and they have to have some sort of way to control that. So you still have people in danger, and so now you're moving into that realm, and I think you're going to have to walk through that before you can even begin to do an assessment as to what could have been done, what should have been done.
The problem is that, you know, eerily enough, a Texas publication, the Texas Tribune and ProPublica, actually highlighted that this was going to happen more than a year and a half ago. They ran this incredible online series. One was called Hell and High Water, and then they updated it back in January, Boomtown, Floodtown. And basically, they predicted all the things that were going to happen in Houston if a major storm like this ever came through. All the problems with development, and basically development in Houston has never been properly regulated. Yeah. And the problems in terms of environmental damage, because it's not only the fourth largest city, but it's the home to the petrochemical industry in the United States.
And it has more Superfund sites than any major metropolitan area in the country.
And frankly, I'd be curious to hear your thoughts about this too, Ernest, because it seemed to me that there was even though the media were trying, there was a little bit of inequity in terms of the response in different neighborhoods, and even the media getting in and showing a lot more of the damage being done to neighborhoods with very fancy homes where the boats could pull into those subdivisions. I'm not sure that the coverage was as balanced or representing the issues and the problems of the majority of the community.
I think you're absolutely right. I mean, I think that there were a lot of communities that were suffering that didn't get the coverage. And you know, that may be because you could have reporters who were coming in from out of town who didn't really know where to go. You had local reporters who, because of the vastness of the area, couldn't get to some of those areas. I mean, there are a lot of Hispanic areas in Houston that were flooded that didn't get the kind of coverage. There were whole swaths of, because the media tended to focus in the southwest part of town, you had this sort of varying coverage of really nice homes that were underwater, and then you could go a couple of miles and you would find some pretty, you know, poor areas that were also suffering from that. You did see some of that from, believe it or not, from the Weather Channel. Yeah.
I spent a lot of time watching the Weather Channel.
The Weather Channel showed many of those neighborhoods whereas if you go to CNN or you go to some of the other, you didn't see that. So it was real interesting depending on what you were looking at. But you're absolutely right, because Houston is such a large place, and it has such a diversity of both ethnicity as well as language as well as economics, it's difficult to try to get all of those into and show all of that. But if you know you have these people coming in from the outside, they're going to go to where they are told to go.
There was one other media angle that I thought that was interesting, and I think you raised it with some of the links on our blog, and that was basically how well the federal government responded this time compared to Katrina, right? And so there were lots of lessons learned on how not to respond to a natural disaster like this. And I'll say for the most part, so far, what we're able to tell, at least from the public relation management aspect of it, the Trump administration is doing a lot better than the Bush administration did when it came to the perception of how these resources are being, you know,
and I think it may also be too soon to tell if it's more than just perception and if the response really is better.
The other thing that I would say is that on several occasions, the governor, Greg Abbott, was given an opportunity to criticize Sylvester Turner, the mayor of Houston, and he didn't take it. And the relationship between the two of them is not very good. But the state of Texas under Abbott responded under some really harsh conditions in a way that you didn't see happen in the state of Louisiana back during Katrina. And so I think that there was more coordination between the cities, the counties, and the state and the federal government in this instance than you saw back during Katrina.
Okay, so there was something I had wanted to talk to you both about, this issue last week, but we ended up running out of time before we could. So it seems just as appropriate this week, given the nonstop Harvey coverage we've seen coming out of Texas. Nick Stockton has an interesting essay in Wired that gets into the new FOMO, the idea of fear of missing out, our society's addiction to breaking news. It might be the 24-hour coverage on air, online, and in print of the hurricane. It might be the revolving door that is the staffing of the Trump administration, the near-weekly missile tests coming out of North Korea. We're addicted to our devices in ways we never have been before, and we're finding that and research is finding that we're giving up relationships with real people because we're afraid we might miss something in the breaking news cycle if we take time away from a television set, a radio, from social media, or from our email, our push alerts.
Yeah, I mean, what's the scientific term for it? Surveillance gratification seeking, I think is what they call it, right? Yeah. And it's real. And I mean, I think we're probably all feeling that effect sometimes ourselves. I'm always pulling out my phone first thing in the morning, all day long. And if you want to do something about it, here's what you can do. Learn how to manage your notification settings on your phone, because that's where you can control whether you get alerts, email, text alerts, news alerts, whatever. And you've got to really be draconian about it. You've got to say, I'm only going to have alerts come in from my friends and family. I'm only going to have news alerts come in from a few trusted sources. I'm only going to have alerts coming in from social media from people who are my friends or whatever. Otherwise, you will be bombarded with this.
No, you're absolutely right. I mean, I've gotten to the point now where my notifications are pretty much limited to texts from friends and family and email. Mm-hmm. And that's it. I don't receive any other notifications that come through any of my devices, because you will find yourself either looking at your phone all the time, or if you have an Apple Watch like Mike and I have, you're always looking down at your wrist because there's always something that could be flat. And it creates anxiety, and it causes you to be thinking about that as opposed to what
your brain never shuts down because you're in that, you're constantly drinking from the information fire hose.
Yes, absolutely.
I'd be curious to hear from you, Amy, because if anybody posts more to social media than you, I'm not sure who it is. And one of the things in this article was suggested that the more you post, the less likely you are to be obsessive about checking all the time, and it's more of a balanced sort of.
So here's where I may fall outside of that is that I still have, as somebody who worked for a good 15 years in a breaking news environment, I do have that need to know right now. If North Korea is testing missiles, I want to know about it. If you know, if the president is, I'm not necessarily looking at every single one of his tweets or getting, you know, push alerts on those, but I need to know if there's something going on there. I wanted to know immediately when Sean Spicer left the White House or when Scaramucci was out or whatever it might have been. I can't not be connected. Like, unless I know there's something on TV I want to watch in real time, I'll DVR it and watch CNN and primetime or whatever that might be out of the fear of not knowing what's going on.
But even then, it's a little more healthy if you're also, if you have a social life where you're posting content. And if you're, at least if you want to know all the time, you're getting it from one or two sources and not from 10 or 15 different sources that are constantly notifying you.
Yeah, probably being the old school guy in the bunch here. I'm very comfortable in getting my news in at certain times of the day. And when I'm not getting it at that time, I'm okay with that. I get news in the morning. I may get a little bit.
See,
after
I would say you probably have the healthier approach to it, frankly. Well, you know, we spent a lot of time on last Wednesday's show talking about what happened in Charlottesville and the impact the white supremacist demonstrations had in that community, the news coverage of it, and the position that journalists were in while covering it. Well, we were talking about, at the same time we were talking about it, ESPN was feeling the blowback of a management decision to reassign broadcaster Robert Lee, taking him off of this Saturday's UVA home opener against William & Mary, sending him instead to the Youngstown Pitt game. ESPN claims that its intentions here were noble, that they were good, that they didn't want to create any kind of an issue. At the same time, it kind of makes me want to clutch my pearls that I forgot to put on this morning and say, bless their heart. How could they not expect this to blow up in their face?
Yeah, I mean, I don't understand why they did it. I mean, I would have just let it play out, you know, and see what happens. I mean, by moving him from that game to another game, you open up.
They draw the attention to it.
You draw the attention, you open it up, and they have been, ESPN has been dealing with a lot of issues over the last 12 months in terms of layoffs, in terms of who was laid off and who wasn't, contracts that were given to some people that figured weren't stars, who have been elevated to stars, and the whole push by Fox Sports to sort of take some of the, you know, some of the mantle away from ESPN when it comes to national sports. So yeah, I just don't understand why they opened up the door for this.
I don't really buy the argument of some on the right who say that this is just an example of ESPN leaning liberal, but I do think it is, to a certain extent, at least politically correct behavior run amok. And I think it was a business decision purely. It wasn't out of concern about whether or not Robert Lee, the anchor, would be harassed or shamed or whatever. It was all about the fact that they were going to take every precaution possible not to be criticized. And in the process, they opened themselves up to criticism.
No, I think you're absolutely right. I do think that I agree with you, Mike, that this whole issue about, you know, ESPN has a liberal slant. ESPN has a we need to make money slant. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's what this is all about.
Yeah. Well, the issue over statues and monuments and schools and the like being named after Robert E. Lee, it's real. And it's also starting to play out here at home as parents and members of the larger community ask the Columbia Public Schools to consider a name change at Lee Expressive Arts Elementary.
Tonight, nearly two dozen parents showed up at a special meeting at Lee Expressive Arts Elementary School to discuss the process of changing the school's name. Several parents said Columbia Public Schools needs to start the dialogue now and take action. According to school board member Jonathan Sessions, at one point, previous school board members were approached with the idea of changing the school's name, but nothing was done then.
We recognize the history that name includes. And, I'll be honest, maybe this board missed an opportunity to rename the building then.
So clearly this isn't the first time that the issue has come up. We heard Sessions allude to that. The school board's going to take it up again September 11th, so chances are we'll talk a little bit more of the coverage at that point. I wanted to bring up the piece that the Tribune had on the front page on Sunday. Pretty interesting looking at the Civil War history and culture and how that's memorialized in our area.
I mean, I think that, you know, the county, the city, the school board, they're all dealing with the same issues that we're dealing with nationally is what role does these names on schools, do the monuments themselves play in the culture of your area? And is that something that you actually want it to represent? And now they're struggling with how do we deal with this in a way that doesn't turn violent?
Mm-hmm. Okay. I mean, I'm glad we're having the conversation, and I've been a big critic of the Tribune ever since the sale, but I have to say that piece that you referenced was the most contextualized story of all the ones that were done locally, and this is a conversation we need to have. I mean, I've lived here for 31 years, and I didn't even know that school was named after Robert E. Lee.
I will admit, I looked it up, frankly, as everything was going on in Charlottesville. I knew it was Lee, but I didn't know if it was Robert E. Lee. Well, there's no better endorsement for a book than to have a spot atop the New York Times bestseller list, especially when there's a chance there might be a movie deal down the road. Maybe that's why it seemed strange when a book no one had ever heard of from a publishing house that was brand new bumped The Hate U Give off of the Times Young Adult list, a spot that it had had for the better part of 6 months. Lainey Serum's book for Mortals is a mystery that is published by an arm of the website Geek Nation. It turns out this was a strategic move accomplished through a complicated scheme to pre-order thousands of copies of the book. Interestingly enough, the New York Times is going to reissue the list and has denoted what has gone on with this book with a dagger. That's the icon, is a dagger.
Well, you know, it's a really fascinating story, and we don't have time to do justice to it now, but you've got a link to it. But the thing is, this was a very sophisticated campaign, not only by that new publishing house, but by the author, who's also an actor who's trying to get a movie deal made around the book. And they were very careful for a while to make sure that they flew under the radar of the New York Times checks and balances system, but they got caught by fans on social media and by their own greed.
Well, there you go. We wanted to make sure we left enough time for this one, because when I first heard about it on Morning Edition last week, I immediately had a flashback to a show from just about a year ago in which I asked both of you to talk to me about your first seven jobs. Ernest, remember telling us about this?
Worked as a token taker for Showbiz Pizza, which my wife still gives me grief for.
Well, and apparently I do too. Now, well, in most markets, Showbiz was taken over by Chuck E. Cheese, and both restaurants have been known for their bad pizza, the arcade games, and the band.
Cheer up, Sleepy Cheese. Oh, what can it mean to
the band is going to be taking its final bow, breaking up after all of these years. You know, one of the best comments I saw about this on the NPR story, I blame Yoko.
Well, when you sent this to me and I pulled it up, it brought back some horrific memories. So, and, you know, it's time. I thought it was already gone. So that just pretty much sums it up for me.
I'm
not nostalgic at all about it being about it going away.
Hey, I got to say, the Columbia store, which doesn't have the animatronics, gets a four out of five on Yelp. So.
Then maybe the pizza isn't as bad as
maybe
I remember.
Maybe not.
Okay, well, what do you know? Okay, we are pretty much out of time for this week. I'd like to thank you for spending the last half hour with us. You can read more about all of the topics we talked about today, including more on the article having to do with that New York Times bestseller list and the removal of the book from that. That's all on our links blog under the programs tab at kbia.org. We also invite you to like us on Facebook or follow us on Twitter. Our handle is @viewsonkbia. These are all great ways to watch and listen to our program again, to leave us comments or questions, see previews of what we'll be talking about next week, and more. Some thank yous now. First to RJI's Travis McMillan for directing today's show, to Tim Pilcher, he's the composer of our original theme music, and a very, very special thank you to Pat Akers, who is with us this week for the last time after 30 years with KBIA. Pat is retiring this week, so a very big thank you to you, Pat, for making us sound good week in and week out. I'm Amy Simons. Be sure to join us again next week when we're back with you for another edition of Views of the News.
Pat's been doing it for almost 30 years. Yeah. However long.
Here we come, walking down the street. We get the funniest looks from everyone we meet. And here we're the monkeys. People say we monkey around. We're too busy singing to put anybody down. We go wherever we want, do what we like to do.